This month, the insights of an informed outsider, Andrew West, speaking about Catholic culture wars. He's introduced by Australian Catholic Historical Society President Dr. John Carmody.
Andrew, I first met when he was state political editor for the Sydney Morning Herald, and he went to university with my wife's cousin, who was at Macquarie, Luke Foley. His sister Bridget is with us today. So Andrew was educated at Sydney University and at Columbia, and brings very considerable intellectual as well as political experience to his present job, which he wanted me to confine my address to as presenter of the Religion and Ethics Report. And he's going to be talking about Catholic culture wars. Now, that's a very interesting topic for all sorts of reasons. Culture wars is a word that's been used in political terms in Australia a great deal in the last few years, particularly introduced by John Winston Howard. His name, which is named after Winston Churchill, indicates the era that he feels most comfortable in and most loyal to. He introduced the concept of culture wars. Australia has always been a land of contention and culturally contention, even if that word used in the same sentence as Australia is a bit problematical. However, we're using the word culture in its broader sense, the culture of the area which we've been brought up. So Andrew, who is best known to probably one of the best known people in Sydney and best known people in Australia, for all that we keep hearing dire warnings that the ABC is in decline and all the rest of it, Andrew is very well known, and it was a great pleasure for me, and a good deal of effort, I have to tell you, a good deal of effort, because he's a humble man, and he's a parishioner of St. Paul's Anglican Parish of Burwood, if I remember rightly, and that's one of the most active Anglican parishes in Sydney. So he brings a political, intellectual and religious role to what he does as the presenter of that report, and it's a great privilege and honour to have you here, Andrew. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you all. I just want to say I am actually humbled to be here in the company of so many learned people. I just point out too, yes, my very old friend, Professor Bridget Griffin Foley, one of this country's finest historians. I was at Bridget's 21st birthday. I was at her 30th birthday. It would be ungentlemanly to name subsequent birthdays. And our very dear and honourable and redoubted friend, Father Ed Campion. There are many others, but I just want to particularly say to Ed and to Bridget that it's great to be in your company. Now, as Jack did point out, despite 30 years of great appreciation for Catholic social teaching, I'm not a Catholic. I'm, as they say, an Anglican in Sydney, not a Sydney Anglican, although I am far less of a combatant in that culture war than I used to, because, you know, I think these things can get very unnecessarily personal and combative and defeats the purpose of our Christian unity, or indeed the unity of all peoples of faith. So I'm not a Catholic, but I've got a great deal of respect, and I've dedicated considerable time over the last 25 years to an appreciation of Catholic social teaching. I've been in this building and in this crypt many times over the years at events that the Aquinas Academy has run. So many of you are probably veterans of the so-called Catholic culture wars, in a way, because this is not a new phenomenon. It probably goes back at least until the late 1960s and the 1968 encyclical on birth control. But I'm going to restrict my remarks to what I think is the latest chapter and maybe the most vehement chapter in the Catholic culture war, and that has been since Pope Francis came to the papacy. Now, I just want to start with four statements that are just basic fact. They're just basic fact. Pope Francis is pro-life from conception to natural death. He believes every child should have a natural mother and father. He exalts motherhood, so he's opposed to things like surrogacy. He believes in the strict biological definition of male and female. Certainly one of his charities in Rome does assist a community of transgender prostitutes, but it is always with the aim of getting them out of prostitution. He supports the traditional definition of marriage. He says there can be civil unions for same-sex couples, but not marriage. He also says, however, the lives of gay people should not be criminalised. So on each of these major moral or life issues, abortion, gender, sexuality, the natural family, the Pope is an Orthodox Catholic. He ticks all the boxes. So what is all the fuss about? This is a question that I have posed on multiple occasions to various guests who are part of, on the programme, who have been part of this culture war. What is the fuss about? Well, you can only assume that part of this modern cultural Catholic culture war is to do with power. The historians among us will correct me, but he is the first pope in centuries not to be from Europe, although José María Bergoglio, his name, he is of solid Italian heritage. What he does acknowledge, though, is that the centre of church activity has shifted quite dramatically from Europe, especially old Europe, Western Europe, and the Anglo-American world to the global south. I remember the head of a conservative Catholic think tank in the United States said to me once, he didn't say it on the record, so I can't name him, but he said this Pope has a, quote, studied indifference to the Anglo-American world. Now, perhaps that comes from being from Latin America, where he has seen at times the very destructive influence of American foreign policy. Perhaps he does not wish to be caught up in what he sees as the principal culture wars in the United States at the moment, which are to do with specifically gender. This former shift is seen, and this is a very controversial point though, this power shift rather, this shift in the Pope's thinking is seen in his overture to China. Now, I acknowledge this is in fact in some ways quite troubling. China is arguably the world's fastest growing Christian mission field. There's estimated to be as many as 150 million Christians in China. I think, however, the Catholic Church, in what is the Patriotic Catholic Association, that is official church, has probably only about 14 to 15 million members. You know, we say only 14 to 15 members, but in China that's a relatively small group of Catholics. The Pope is obviously looking at China and seeing an enormous opportunity for Catholic mission. He also sees enormous competition, great competition from evangelicals, Protestants, Pentecostals. It may be that there's as many as 100 million underground evangelical and Pentecostal Christians in China. So the Pope has obviously made what some people consider to be a Faustian bargain with the Chinese government. And this does involve acknowledging the Chinese Communist government's ability to have a say in the appointment of bishops, which I think outside of one particular province or one particular diocese in France, I think it's Strasbourg, doesn't happen anywhere else in the Catholic world. So to give the Chinese Communist government a say in the appointment of bishops is quite a compromise. And you can see the tension over this is encapsulated by two people, the former Archbishop of Hong Kong, Cardinal Joseph Zen, who's a very brave man. He's just been arrested by the Hong Kong police for his support of the pro-democracy movement. He's very worried about the Pope's opening to China and the agreement that he's reached on the appointment of bishops. The new bishop of Hong Kong, Bishop Stephen Chow, is much more willing to accept this accommodation. So that's one of the main culture wars that's going on. It is over this question of the shift in power and how much compromise do you make in that shift in power. You look, and of course the Pope is seeing this on home turf back in Latin America. just 2 weeks ago, the number of Protestant Christians in Brazil ticked over to more than half. They now, Brazil, once an absolute bastion, Catholic bastion, is now a very small, slight majority evangelical Protestant, when it comes to Christians, evangelical Protestant nation. One of the reasons that Pope Francis was reportedly elected by his fellow bishops, by his fellow cardinals, was the belief that he understood the competition from evangelicals, and particularly Pentecostals. People speak of them in the same breath, and, you know, that's defensible in a very broad way, but they are two separate groups, strictly speaking. But he has seen the rise of these forces in Latin America, and he's worked out a way to, if you like, share Christian influence with them. So that is one of the points of contention in this Catholic culture war. The second is the belief, the Pope's belief in the dignity of indigenous peoples. And this came to a crescendo in 2019 at the Synod on the Amazon, where some Amazonian statues known as the Pachamama, which depicted a pregnant mother, again, the Pope's exaltation of motherhood. They depicted a pregnant woman. These statues were thrown into the Tiber because some arch-conservatives saw these statues as idolatrous. And there were many conservative prelates like Cardinal Raymond Burke who supported this action of throwing these statues into the Tiber. The Pope came out and apologised. Interestingly, by the way, the Amazonian Synod did not deliver, by the way, what some liberals had been hoping for, which was married priests. This had been a recommendation from people on the ground in the Amazon saying, look, we do have a severe shortage of priests. The faithful cannot always receive communion, and it is simply impractical in the most remote parts of the Amazon to insist on clerical celibacy. You need to allow, in certain circumstances, married priests, which, of course, the Eastern Rite churches in alliance, in fellowship with the Catholic Church, do allow. So, but the Amazonian Synod did not deliver on married priests, and it did not deliver on women deacons. The second, the third area of contention in this culture war has been the appointment of cardinals. Now, as of, I think, last week, 73% of all the next voting conclave will have been appointed by Francis, and there is a huge shift away from the traditional European and North American power centres. Cardinals from places like Mongolia, Malaysia, Tonga, Sweden, although I think Sweden was in a previous naming of cardinals, but places where Catholics are in fact at the margins. But Pope Francis really wants to emphasise and reach out to Catholics in places where they are not in a majority. The irony is, of course, I think for many, is that the church, people who fear that the church is going down this, you know, inexorably liberal road under Pope Francis, is that many of the Catholic bishops that, and cardinals that he's appointed, and many of the parts of the world that he has tried to cultivate, are places where people have very traditional views on things like the family. So it doesn't entirely fit with the fear of conservatives that the Pope's concentration on the global south will mean a liberal church. There's also this observation that Pope Francis is something of a Peronist in the old-fashioned left-wing populist tradition. Now, I do believe that he radiates a genuine gentleness, a genuine sense of love and pastoral concern for all Catholics. I truly believe that. But he is also, and even his allies have pointed this out, a tough political operator. He can be, apparently, quite ruthless in the way that he has dealt with some dissenters, people who he sees as standing in the way of his attempt not to make the church more liberal, but certainly more transparent and accountable. And in the United States in particular, many of the bishops have suddenly realised, look, we thought we came from a tough political culture, but we're up against a real veteran, and they're shaken by that. They're shaken by the fact that they have a competitor in this competition. Another area is, unsurprisingly, about money and the Pope's attitude to wealth. Pope Francis is, in the European context, most likely not a socialist or a communist. He is most likely an old-fashioned post-World War II Christian Democrat. He's not a Marxist. He was never a full-blown believer in liberation theology. He did bring back into the church and restore the priestly functions and privileges of a number of priests in Nicaragua, including the late... his name has slipped my mind, but he served as the foreign minister in the Sandinista government, the first Sandinista government, not this latest one. He was a Marianol priest.
And his name was Father Miguel Descoto Brockman.
He did bring back and restore his right to fulfil all his priestly functions, but the Pope has never been a full-blown liberation theologian, but he most assuredly is not an economic neoliberal. But frankly, no pope has been. As I like to point out, Pope Benedict and Pope John Paul II before him both rejected the idea of the complete laissez-faire state. They both spoke of the preeminence in the tradition of Rerum Novarum, about the primacy of labour over capital. It's just that this pope has said it with a lot more vigour. And Laudato Si, his first major encyclical, which was ostensibly about the environment, but it was also a searing critique of capitalism. In fact, at one point, he described capitalism in its worst manifestations as murderous. Well, of course, in places like the United States, for many millionaire and billionaire Catholics, they said that they might even withdraw their support for Catholic charities and institutions if the Pope continued to speak this way. It was literally a red flag to them. So there again we see one of the lightning rods of this Catholic culture war. There's also been the Pope's attitude to religious outreach, not just ecumenism towards fellow Christians, but interfaith religious outreach as well. And in fact, his critics in this culture war accuse him of syncretism. At one point, he did ask Muslims to pray for him. As fellow people of faith, he's quite close to the head of the Al-Azhar University in Cairo, which is one of the world's most respected centres of Islamic thinking. He made a visit, a very moving visit to Israel, where he visited both Yad Vashem but also the security separation wall, where he lamented the division in Israeli society. He met a leading Ayatollah, not the Ayatollah, there are many Ayatollahs. He met a leading Ayatollah, a Shia Ayatollah, on his visit to Iraq. And interestingly, he made a visit to, I think it was Sudan recently, in the company not only of the Archbishop of Canterbury, but the moderator of the Presbyterian Church of Scotland. And someone might remind me if this has changed, but I do think the Westminster Confession, which the Presbyterian Church of Scotland, I do think the Westminster Confession still contains a reference to the Pope as the Antichrist. And yet here the three of them were getting on famously on a mission visit to South Sudan. But of course, this is very disturbing to a lot of the more hardline Catholics. On his deathbed, in a letter that was leaked in January, the late Cardinal Pell argued that the Pope, and the Pope had, by the way, given strong support to Cardinal Pell in his legal battles and in Cardinal Pell's right to pursue his vindication right up to the High Court. There was no question that the Pope felt that Cardinal Pell had every right to pursue his vindication right up to the High Court. But on his deathbed, in this sort of deathbed letter, Cardinal Pell said that the Pope had created an atmosphere of doubt about traditional Catholic teaching, about doubt. He wasn't saying that the Pope was in any sense the Antichrist. He wasn't arguing, I think it's called a Sedevacantist position, that he's not really the Pope. He just argued that this Pope was creating doubt, and that's why he said this papacy, in his view, was a failure. Now, this, I suspect, is especially so for many Catholic conservatives and many of his critics on the question of sexuality and gay rights. Now, it's important to point out here, Pope Francis has not changed a jot of Catholic teaching on this question. And he has not proposed to change Catholic teaching on this question of sexuality. He argues that sexual relations and sexuality is to be expressed purely in the context of a marriage between a man and a woman. But he has changed the tone. And that, again, has ignited a culture war. This is most famous in his comment a few years ago, "Who am I to judge?" Now, people forget the context of that comment. He was asked about a gay Catholic negotiating his or her way through the faith. And the Pope simply said that if someone is sincerely seeking to understand God and they happen to be gay, who am I to judge? Again, there was no change in doctrine. And in fact, most recently, in March 2021, the Pope said the Church cannot bless same-sex unions. He said it was a sin. Now, it's true that sections of the German Church are pushing to change the doctrine, to change the teaching on sexuality, and that to the critics of Pope Francis, this has, you know, he has been encouraging this. He has not clamped down on this kind of loose talk with sufficient vigour. And this, again, is something that troubles them. But I point out to you, there's no change in doctrine. And even people I would describe as moderate conservatives, like Archbishop Coleridge here in Australia, have said that the language, which uses very blunt terms like intrinsically disordered about gay people, really needs to change. But it's a simple change of language. It's to be more pastoral. It's to be more loving, as opposed to a change of doctrine. The same thing, of course, has occurred on the question of divorce. And this, in many ways, ignited the latest round of the culture war. We only have to go back, I think it was 2016, to his encyclical Amoris Laetitia. And buried in that document was a footnote, just a footnote. But the footnote said something to the effect of, there may be circumstances in which a Catholic who is divorced and civilly remarried without an annulment may, with the permission and the understanding and the pastoral love of the bishop, be admitted to communion. That was all, a footnote, highly specific, highly restricted, and yet this ignited this enormous controversy. So much so that four cardinals, including the ubiquitous Cardinal Raymond Burke of the United States, issued what was called a dubia, a question, questioning the theological rigour of this statement. And the late Cardinal Pell was not a signatory. He was not one of the four cardinals, but he did, at the very time when he was serving effectively in the Pope's cabinet, speak up in favour of the cardinals who'd issued the dubia and said, well, there's nothing wrong with asking questions, really, is there? So, you know, this little footnote ignited a huge controversy. Then there's the Pope's emphasis on climate change and immigration. Now, on these questions, by the way, Pope Francis is, in fact, largely in sync with even the mainstream conservatives in the Church, particularly in the United States. The Catholic Bishops' Conference in the United States is very much in favour of a much more compassionate position on immigration, asylum seekers, refugees. The conservative Catholic hierarchy in the United States really does support that. And they've even bought into the Vatican position on climate change. But there is, as you probably know, a movement called the Rad-Trad movement, the Radical Traditionalists, which tend to be on the fringes of the Church. They do have quite a few priests associated with them and the occasional bishop. but they have become very upset about the Pope's position on immigration in particular, because particularly in Europe, they see it as threatening the Judeo-Christian heritage of Europe. And they've associated themselves, so much so is their anger, they've associated themselves with some of the nationalist forces in European politics. And then finally, there is the issue which many of you will be familiar with, and that is the Latin Mass. This has become a touchstone for some ultra-conservative critics of the Pope. Now, Pope Benedict, who is seen to be the champion of the Latin Mass, was not totally sold, by the way, on the idea of the Latin Mass as the principal expression of Catholic worship. He certainly loosened some of the restrictions on the use of the Latin Mass. But there was no way that he had a laissez-faire attitude to the Latin Mass, and Pope John Paul II certainly didn't either. But Pope Francis has seen that the Latin Mass has become a rallying point for those who oppose his papacy, but also those who he thinks opposes even mainstream Catholicism. And he has tightened the rules on the use of the Latin Mass. As I understand it, the Latin Mass is still permitted in highly circumscribed situations with episcopal permission. So these are some of the big divisive issues. Now, out of these fights have come a couple of extraordinary incidences. Most infamously was in 2018 in the letter from Archbishop Carlo Mario Vigano, who was the former papal nuncio to the United States. And he explicitly called something that I'd never heard of. He had explicitly called on Pope Francis to resign. And this was allegedly over the handling of the situation with the disgraced Archbishop of Washington, the now laicized former Cardinal Theodore McCarrick. Vigano alleged that the Pope had somehow reinstated McCarrick despite allegations of sexual misconduct. Now, the reality was, and the Vatican investigated this, it was actually Pope John Paul II who had heard reports of Theodore McCarrick's misbehaviour. Pope Benedict XVI had asked for McCarrick's resignation and told him that he had to live in seclusion, but McCarrick ignored him. Francis inherited the McCarrick problem, but he believed that Benedict had dealt with the situation regarding Theodore McCarrick. He also, at the time, understood the evidence against McCarrick to be inconclusive, because the situation with McCarrick was this. There had been rumours for decades that he had behaved improperly, but with adult seminarians, young adult seminarians, but nonetheless young adult seminarians, that he had even asked them to share beds with him, and that he'd asked them to refer to him as Uncle Ted and this sort of thing. Until 2018, there had never been any evidence that McCarrick had engaged in criminal activity, and it was only in 2018 that the report suggests that evidence became available that McCarrick had abused a choir boy in his mid-teens. At that point, the Pope took the most dramatic action you could against McCarrick, and that was to have him laicized, which he now is. But Vigano, as we now discover, when he was the papal nuncio, was, and the report, the Vatican report uncovered this, Vigano himself, the Pope's accuser himself, failed to take the necessary steps to investigate to the requisite sort of depth the misbehaviour of Theodore McCarrick. Vigano also formed an extraordinary alliance with someone whom you may have heard of, one Steve Bannon. Steve Bannon, who was advisor for some time to Donald Trump. Steve Bannon is quite a brilliant man, by the way, and if you were, and, you know, if you were a Catholic conservative, you'd be lucky to have him on your side. But Bannon's fingerprints are all over a lot of the anti-Francis plotting. At one point, Steve Bannon leased a seminary in the hills outside Rome. And this seminary was supposed to be a place where he would cultivate Orthodox traditional Catholic thought. Bannon himself came out and attacked the Pope for the escalating sexual abuse crisis. This was, I think, about the time when the Pope had taken very dramatic action in Chile, demanding the resignations of all the Catholic bishops in Chile, all of the Catholic bishops saying, give me your resignations now. It took a very dramatic action, but at the time, Bannon came out and attacked the Pope and saying there'd be no Catholic Church left unless the Pope dealt with this crisis. And that is true. Unless the Catholic Church deals with the crisis conclusively, there will be no Catholic Church left. But it isn't true to say that the Pope had somehow ignored this. So he opened a seminary, or he hoped to open a seminary in the hills outside of Rome. In fact, Steve Bannon said it was going to be a modern, and I assume he is speaking metaphorically, gladiator school. One of those who he also brought into this orbit was Matteo Salvini. Matteo Salvini is the leader of a hard right nationalist party in Rome, in Italian politics. Salvini famously emerged on the campaign trail wearing a T-shirt which said "Benedict is my Pope." In a way, by the way, that upset, reportedly, the late Pope Benedict, for his name to be weaponized like this in this culture war. But Matteo Salvini said, "Benedict is my Pope." Now, why did he say this? Well, partly because he was considered to be the anti-Francis, also because they harken back to a controversial speech that Benedict made that he later qualified, which was seen as being inflammatory in its anti-Islamic rhetoric. It wasn't an anti-Islamic speech, but it did contain perhaps some clumsy language. Then in 2020, we had the Republican Party under President Trump effectively weaponising the Catholic Church in its battle with, or in his battle with Joe Biden, who would go on to become only the second Catholic president of the United States. Just after the major Black Lives Matter protests, some of which did turn violent, I acknowledge, but just after some of those protests, you'll recall that Donald Trump paraded himself before the Episcopal Church that's just opposite the White House, holding up a Bible. I think he held it upside down. And he later went to the shrine in Washington, the shrine to Pope John Paul II. Even the conservative Catholic bishop said, this was too much, please do not weaponize our late Pope, the one they call St. John Paul the Great, please do not weaponize him. We then had the spectacle of the dueling nuns at the Democratic and Republican conventions. The Democrats had a Sister Simone Campbell, a very distinguished lawyer. The Republicans had a Sister Deirdre Byrne, an equally distinguished surgeon. We had two highly qualified, highly impressive women, but on different sides of this divide in the Catholic Church. Simone Campbell gave a benediction one day at the Democratic National Convention. She didn't endorse any particular ticket, but it was very clear that there were common themes. She spoke about Catholic social justice, healthcare, etc., and that probably reflected well at the time on Joe Biden. Sister Deirdre Byrne was a little more explicit. She said that the Biden-Harris presidential ticket was the most, quote, anti-life ticket in US political history. On that score, if you use the term anti-life, she may be correct. Because, and this is the final chapter in this Catholic culture war, if you like, Joe Biden has evolved from what was once a kind of classic culturally conservative blue-collar Labour Democrat to someone much more liberal. You'll recall that 30 years ago, many Democrats, including my old friend Father Robert Drynan, who was a Jesuit priest who served for 10 years in the United States Congress, whose position on abortion has been seriously misrepresented by his critics, but many Catholics thought, well, we've cracked the code. Bill Clinton, ironically a Southern Baptist, had cracked the code when he said that abortion should be always safe, generally legal, but rare. And they thought, you know, and Hillary Clinton, when she was running in 2016, said, and I mean really rare. Well, today the position of the Democrats is that abortion is just another healthcare procedure, and that has led, I think, even many moderate Catholics to ask, to what extent is Joe Biden really an observant Catholic? Pope Francis has refused to buy into this argument, saying that the communion should not be denied to Joe Biden or to other Catholics who are liberal on abortion. He says that, I think his phrase is something like, communion is not a reward for the perfect, but a balm for those who are struggling or for the suffering faithful. But that really sort of encapsulates that situation with Joe Biden. To what extent is he really a Catholic if he rejects, at least in a public platform, Catholic teaching on abortion and, to some extent, sexuality? So all of these threads coming together represent the latest chapter in the Catholic culture war. Why do I think, though, this is so much more powerful and potentially destructive than previous wars, as it were, Catholic culture wars? Well, it's turbocharged by technology. Pope Francis recently put out a statement about the evils, and it is evil in many ways, of social media and the online world. Not just the obvious evil of sexually exploitative material involving women and children, but the evil that involves the polarisation. And the Catholic world has been intensely polarised during this papacy because it coincides with the rise of social media, to the point where our old friend, in inverted commas, Cardinal Vigano, Archbishop Vigano, certainly not a cardinal, our old friend, in inverted commas, Archbishop Vigano, during the COVID pandemic, did not simply question some of the COVID restrictions, and there were some legitimate questions to ask about how fair those restrictions were in stopping acts of worship that could be socially distanced while not stopping other forms of public activity. There were some legitimate questions there, but Archbishop Vigano even went on to question the existence of COVID itself. So that, in a way, summarises this Catholic culture war that we face in 2023. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Andrew. Now, Andrew has in discussion with me by electronic media, not by social media.
Actually, by speaking to each other. Yeah.
We have, and he's very keen that we make this as much a participatory experience as possible. So he hopes that he's provoked a lot of questions, a lot of comments in people's minds, and that people will indeed get up and speak their mind openly and contest what he said in pay if they like, endorse what he said, but engage in a proper Q&A in a respectful, if not warlike, manner. So could I ask people to keep that in mind? He wants this to be a kind of synod, in other words, to use a phrase that you haven't discussed.
I didn't mention the synod and synodality, which I think the greatest problem is its name, but anyway, not its sentiment, not its impulse, but its name, but anyway. Yep.
So please, leap to your feet and have your say.
And feel free to disagree with anything I said, by the way.
With all these different forces competing within the church as you've laid them out, I'm thinking particularly, for example, of the German bishops at the moment, and there are other things. Do you think there'll be a schism?
Well, there probably already is. That's the point. There probably already is. And I think it's true to say, as a generalisation, that the most active part of the church is that which sees itself in opposition to Pope Francis. The schism, there won't be a schism in a formal sense, just like there won't ultimately be a schism in the Anglican Church in Australia, because there's something pretty atavistic, pretty base at its core, and that is property. You know, what happens when you walk away from the church? Will you lose access to property? You lose access to places of worship. But I think what you'll continue to have is a number of bishops. You've got Bishop Strickland in Texas, for example, who's very active on hard right Twitter, particularly challenging, I think, the government, the US administration on immigration, but also on gender issues. You've got him. He's now been put in a formal disciplinary procedure of the church. But I think you'll have bishops like him push the margins as far as possible. And interestingly, the notion of synodality may permit this. This is what I think some of Francis's critics don't quite get. He's made it very clear, the Vatican's made it very clear, this coming synod on synodality in October isn't about, quote-unquote, democratising the church. It's not about democratising the church. I think there's two women who will have voting rights in this. It's not about democratising the church. It's about, in a sense, that Catholic social teaching of subsidiarity, of devolving the church. And when you devolve the church, that may mean that conservatives in the church will be able to have what they consider to be more authentic expressions of their Catholicism. So, in a way, a schism is unnecessary. They may, in fact, get a series of churches within churches. And as long as no one steps outside official church teaching, and this includes the liberals, by the way, the church will hold together in an unwieldy but enduring way. As someone pointed out to me when I first started this job, and I thought I knew something about the Catholic Church, and he said, Andrew, the church doesn't think in terms of five-year plans, it thinks in 500-year plans.
This is a supplementary to that. What do you think the next pope's big challenge will be? What's Francis left for the next pope to handle? You know, he's changed the office of the papacy to some degree, I think.
Yeah. Well, apparently the pope, by the way, has got an undated signed resignation letter. He said that he does not want to be in a position where he's not mentally capable of discharging the duties of the office. And here's another interesting thing, of course, which everyone here knows, but it's always good to be reminded of. The Pope who did the most radical thing in the history of the modern papacy was Benedict by retiring. As I said in the opening remarks, 73% of the voting cardinals at the next conclave have been appointed by Francis himself. I think there's probably a growing consensus that the next pope will come from either Asia or Africa, certainly not from the United States, certainly not from Europe. Although the emissary that the pope has sent to try to end the Ukraine-Russia war, which I should add is another issue of tension, by the way, some of the more Anglo-American-oriented bishops are very angry that the Pope has not taken a more explicit stand in defence of Ukraine. Well, of course, they forget one of the very first things the Pope did was break all protocol at the start of the Ukraine war and get in the car and drive over to see the Russian ambassador to the Vatican and say, "This is not on. Stop what you're doing." Now, of course, it didn't work. But nonetheless, the Pope did make clear his view that Russia was the aggressor, but he's also spoken about the other tensions in the prelude to that war that NATO powers may have contributed to by their own ambiguity or their own, at times unnecessarily bellicose statements towards Russia. So there's a lot of anger, by the way, among some, that the Pope has not taken a more hardline position in favour of Ukraine. But this cardinal that he has sent to try to sort out to try to mediate this war is someone who's considered papable, I think is the phrase. He's the cardinal who is the pastor to the Community of St. Egidio, which is a beautiful organisation that helped bring peace to Mozambique. So he may be a contender as well. He is an Italian.
You mentioned the recent round of appointments for cardinals.
Yeah.
And Australia, of course, missed out on that.
Which I think is the first time, Ed may be able to correct me, but I think it's the first time since the end of World War II that we have not had a cardinal, a living cardinal. I think we've always had a cardinal since the early post-war years. This is the first time we've never had a cardinal.
Yeah, it's often said that popes, in a way, try to stack the next conclave by appointing cardinals of similar views. Do you think there's any evidence of that under the present pope?
Well, if by similar views you mean cardinals who are more attentive to the areas of actual growth in the Catholic Church, which corresponds with the growth in the worldwide population, Asia and Africa and Latin America, then yes, I guess it is true that he hopes a like-minded successor will come along. If people think the like-minded successor is a quote-unquote social liberal, because there's no evidence that Pope Francis is a social liberal, simply speaking in more pastoral, loving terms about people does not make one a social liberal. But if the argument is, oh, he's trying to set the church up to have another liberal as Pope, I'm not sure about that.
Oh, thanks very much for your address. That was very interesting and stimulating. Although, very sadly, Cardinal Pell called the Synod a toxic nightmare, it seems to me that it, apart from all its other advantages, it will be very helpful in a sense, defusing the situation you've described so well, because it's clear from the whole synodal process that the Pope is drawing on the insights and experience and commitment of a very wide range of people in the Church and enabling a process by which we can see different positions and insights developing over the coming years. So it seems to me, in the view of that culture war situation, which, as you said, is particularly bad in the Anglo-Saxon world, the Synod is a very good response to that, a very helpful response.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I did a story on the late Cardinal Pell's sort of deathbed letter. It's not a toxic mess. I do think it's a mess, though. I do think that this Synod is quite badly organised. I do think it could be a better, more rigorous process. I think its greatest risk is that it will not actually resolve anything. I accept your point, Rob, that it has the potential to establish a more pluralist church. But here's the thing. You would say to... You could make the argument to critics of the Pope, but this is your chance. This is, you know, pluralism in the church helps you because you will have your arena in which to express your particular type of Catholicism. But the response comes back, yeah, but the church isn't supposed to be pluralist. The church is not supposed to be pluralist. It is not a democracy. And I guess they wait for the day, for the restoration, as it were, of a pope like Benedict, but one who sort of sticks it out, and one who will govern the church with a more iron fist. So even though I would make the case that the synod on synodality, even if it is rather poorly organised and ill-defined, it will lead to greater pluralism and greater satisfaction for people of all theological tendencies within the church, that is not enough for people who say, no, we want... I mean, remember, Benedict was on the record, I think, saying he was quite happy to have a smaller, leaner, more pure church. He was happy to have a smaller, leaner, more pure church. Now, whether he said that or whether one of his proxies said it, it was definitely the prevailing view during the brief papacy of Benedict.
So in terms of the process of the synod, it seems to me a very strong point about the synod that it's had very much a forward and back feedback process in terms of the initial process and the continental synods and that feeding back and so on, which is, I think, demonstrating a genuine sense of walking together, of synodality in that sense. And different views are accepted insofar as they do not reject papal authority as such, which these hard right people do and is clearly un-Catholic.
Thank you for your talk. I think to some extent you've begun to answer my question, but in terms of synodality, and as I understand it, the Pope's injunction that we should try hard to understand alternative points of view, so that those conversations must continue in the hope that something will emerge between them. Do you think this will influence the ordinary culture of Catholics, allowing them to stand back from dogmatic statements, listen carefully, and hope that eventually something will emerge which is perhaps closer to the spirit of Christ?
Well, the thing is, if you want the church, as some of Pope Francis's critics want, if you want the church to be a political force, then it can't be a pluralist force. It has to be a force that is singular and unified and disciplined in the message that it brings to the societies in which it's present. And it must seek to... And there's a school of thought called Catholic Integralism, which operates in the law, and to various degrees, by the way. I mean, there are some very thoughtful people who you would describe as Catholic integralists, and others who are much more hard-line. But there is an argument that, no, we want a society that's... I don't have a stake in this, not being a Catholic. And I come from a church where the answer to everything is to establish a committee and put it off for 10 years, and establish a 10-year committee, by the way. That's what they do at Lambeth. They have a 10-year committee and deal with it in another 10 years' time. So I really don't know whether it's going to achieve the aims that Pope Francis seeks. I really don't, because I do think there are some people who want that old Benedict model of a leaner, smaller, more orthodox church. I don't know that it will achieve what he wants. And my fear for the synod on synodality is that it will come away with a series of motherhood statements, about listening and discernment, which are important, but in a way they just become what anyone can interpret it the way they want.
Thanks, Andrew. This cuts across the discussion in a sense. It springs from your mention of the social media.
Yep.
And the fact that that has contributed immensely to the waves of uncertainty surrounding Francis. Rain. Some years ago, you wrote an article decrying the increase in fees for the arts and anthropology, etc., saying that this would kill off the academic excellence that we have in these topics.
Yes, and it was reproduced in the Catholic Weekly.
That's where I
with came my up. Permission, but
of
yes,
course,
yes,
that's
yes.
Where I came across it.
Yeah.
My question is that in the ABC now we have a director of news and a director of content who comes from Netflix.
Right.
What is the guarantee, or what will be the process for the ABC guaranteeing the depth and wisdom of its coverage of religion?
Oh, that's not a fair question, Patrick, to ask me especially. So my answer on the record is that's not a fair question to ask me. Well, I'm here to talk about the Catholic the Catholic culture wars.
Fair enough.
I'm glad you asked the question, though, and my gratitude for you asking the question is on the record.
A rather trivial comment or story about the Anglican culture wars.
Yep.
A number of years ago, when I was a student, one of the students in my group was an Anglican, and he said to me, look, Jeff, he said, there's a function on it up at the Anglican Cathedral in Newcastle. Would you like to come up with me? And I said, oh, yes, I'd be quite interested. I did my teacher training in Newcastle. I rather liked the Anglican Cathedral. So we went up, and he was an Anglican. And of course, Newcastle is a high church Anglican diocese. Yep. Sydney is low church. We went in, and the woman who was greeting us asked, said, look, could I have your name and where you're from? And I said, look, I'm from Sydney, however, I'm a Catholic. And she said, oh, you're most welcome. My friend came up behind me, he gave his name. I'm from Sydney, I'm an Anglican. Oh, how unfortunate.
Right. Yeah. I have to say, I think the those culture wars in Sydney, surprisingly, people will be surprised, I think they've settled a little bit. Well, largely because of the absolute dominance of the evangelicals. And there has never been much of a small-c Catholic presence in the diocese, and it's even less now. I mean, the one comment I would make about Anglicanism is in Sydney, unfortunately, if you're not a... And it's not just low church evangelical. If you're not a North American-style evangelical, then the only place you have are a few centres of high church worship. There is nothing for the Anglican like me who would simply describe himself as a prayer book, hymns, vestments and altar Anglican, which isn't a high church. It's simply a liturgical Anglican. There's not much left for those sort of Anglicans. You either gravitate to the diminishing number of actual high church parishes, which may be too high church for your liking, or you're faced with worshipping in some sort of Hillsong Light style service, which doesn't satisfy as many Anglicans as I think some in the diocese thinks it does.
I wondered if the overtures that the Pope, you say, has been making towards China,
yeah,
will remain. Are they strong enough to remain in place when he is no longer there? And the purpose, is the purpose, do you think, as far as he's concerned, to see a lot of congregation as well as priests, people who be able to actually serve the congregations?
Mm. I think his attitude on this is pretty pragmatic. And that is, he feels that Catholic teaching has a lot to offer China. And if the only way that he can get that Catholic teaching, even in some sort of modified form, into the hands and the hearts and the minds of Chinese Christians is by a compromise with the Chinese Communist Party, it's a compromise he's willing to make. He looks at the figures about China, and it's very hard to get accurate figures on Christian identification in China. But it could be around 150 million, which is, 15% of the population. It's very significant. And if you're the Pope, you don't want evangelicals through house churches to soak up all of that Christian curiosity, that Christian impulse. You want to have a, and of course it's very hard, even though the Catholic Church was, of course, for centuries an underground church. It's very hard today for the Catholic Church to be an underground church. It's a church that requires a physical presence. And I'll be corrected on this, there have been, I think, for some decades, cardinals in China who have been named as cardinals, but they have lived secretly. The regime, their names are not known. That is my understanding. But now there is an agreement, essentially, that the government will have a say in the appointment of bishops. Now, will this survive the Pope's, to the next Pope? That I don't know. All it requires is another Pope to say, no, this is a compromise that's too great. This is a bridge too far. I'm sorry, you don't get to choose. You don't get a say in our bishops. I think that's all it maybe takes. I don't know that it survives. It depends on the pragmatism of the next pope.
Andrew, thank you very much. If you look at the history of the church, many governments appointed bishops. If you look back, I'm sure, there was always the government and the and people always had some sort of say in that sort of thing. The ruling class, the kings and bishops, and they were all simultaneous in a way, weren't they?
I think today, outside China, the only place where it occurs is a...
Oh, not today. I'm talking
Take your word for that. I think today, though, the only place outside China is this archdiocese. I think it's centred on Strasbourg, where the French president has nominal say in who is appointed. I think that's about the... and I think maybe something to do with Andorra, because I think a Catholic bishop and the president of France are the co-princes of Andorra. One of those little quirks.
On the China, I think he's being a Jesuit. He's invoking, you know, Matteo Ricci.
Yes. Jesuit. That's a very good observation. The deep Jesuit history in China. That's a very good observation that I'd forgotten about. Thank you.
I think the most recent appointment violates what was the broader understanding between the Catholics and the Chinese government. Isn't it just a very recent appointment? Wasn't that in the face of what the Pope had agreed to in 2018?
Look, I can't be sure of the absolute detail. I know that Bishop Stephen Chow, who's the new Bishop of Hong Kong, is considered to be, let us say, more understanding of the Pope's predicament on this than Cardinal Zen, who was, by the way, Cardinal Zen was a great defender of democracy, and he is now suffering for it. I mean, this man in his 80s, he's been arrested by the Hong Kong police, effectively the Chinese government.
The Archdiocese of Strasbourg,
yep.
As you may well know, that was part of the German Empire from 1870 to 1918, and so it didn't become subject to the laicization laws of the radical French Republic. And was subject to a concordat between the German Empire and the Vatican, and that for some reason that's lingered on. Something of a historical curiosity. Yep. And in terms of when kings and emperors had to stop dabbling in papal elections and appointing bishops and so on, I think the last time that happened was that the Austro-Hungarian emperor still had a role, I think, and Julie may correct me because I know she's an expert in Austrian history. The Austrian emperor still had a role up to the conclave electing Pope Pius X.
Right. So what are we, 1912 or something?
Yes, around that time.
Yeah.
And then obviously the empire collapsed in 1918. So just by way of a...
Thank you. That's more detail than I knew. That's more detail than I knew about Strasbourg.
So I think that we've had many very good and very participatory question times, but I think the seriousness of the questions on this occasion has to mark a high point. So thank you very much indeed.
Thank you. No, thank you. Thank you.
Right. Next month our guest speaker is Paul Collins. He will start, as I mentioned earlier, a little bit later, but... keep coming at 2, because you never know, these speakers at this Catholic function preceding it may run out of breath.
We've been listening to Andrew West speaking to the July meeting of the Australian Catholic Historical Society on Catholic Culture Wars. Andrew is the presenter of ABC Radio National's Religion and Ethics Report. The Q&A which followed the talk was moderated by Dr. John Carmody, president of the Society. ACHS meetings are held on the third Sunday of each month from February to November in the crypt of the Parish Church of St. Patrick, Churchill, Sydney, Australia at 2 p.m. Please see the ACHS website for details of the full program of talks. This ACHS talk was recorded on Gadigal lands and the podcast produced on Wallumedegal lands by me, John Kenny. The Society acknowledges the traditional owners of the places upon which we record and make the podcast, or in which our stream may be heard. On Sunday, the 20th of August 2023, at St. Pat's, our speaker will be freelance religious affairs commentator and former head of ABC Religious Broadcasts, Dr. Paul Collins, who will speak about resolving Catholicism's dichotomies. You're welcome to join us then for more history. Bye for now.